Hi, all, and welcome back to our weekly constitutional law podcast for Wayne State College students in POS 420 American Constitutional Law. This episode will continue our conversation around federalism with a focus on the powers of state governments. So if you wouldn't mind, please go to Canvas, the Week 12 Roadmap page, and open up the Week 12 Federalism State Powers slides. I anticipate this episode is going to be brief like our last one because we don't have a huge range of things to cover, but we do have some pretty intense concepts that we will be talking about in this episode. I've listed a number of those concepts on our objectives slide, slide number 2 for this week. We're going to be talking about the 10th Amendment, and then the critical concepts that go with that are preemption, dormant power theory, and mutual exclusiveness theory. Now, this is definitely going to be a high-level conversation about constitutional law and power, so I encourage you to also utilize outside resources on this topic. It can be helpful to engage with different websites or different articles that might provide more basic explanations of these. Of course, always go back to your textbook, and if it is helpful, utilize that resource as well. Once we've worked through those concepts, we're going to take a brief look at 4 different cases related to the powers of state governments, and a few of these are going to sound familiar because I've kind of touched on them already. So hopefully you are not struck by anything that seems too out of the norm or pretty odd, but yes, we will be talking about 4 different cases, and then we will wrap up early, like I said before. So, turning to slide number 3, in the upper right-hand corner in that orange square, I've outlined what state government has as far as reserved powers. Now, reserved powers are considered to be those powers not explicitly listed in the Constitution that belong to the federal government. You'd see those listed on the left-hand side as enumerated powers. And of course, we do see something like powers denied. So under the state government column, the powers denied are things like taxing imports and exports or coining money, generally because we have recognized that those are listed in the Constitution for the federal government. In the middle column, you have concurrent powers, meaning those powers that actually belong to both levels of government. So both state and federal government can collect taxes or borrow money, obviously make laws and establish their own courts, create banks, corporations, and then they can also take property for public purpose, which is something we will touch on in our last set of slides. Turning to what the 10th Amendment actually says, if you move on to slide 4, what you're going to see there is the language of the 10th Amendment. This is another brief one, but it simply says, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." So in essence, this is kind of that catch-all that the founders and framers were thinking about in terms of, okay, so we don't want the federal government to overstep into literally everything that they could govern because we haven't put that many limits in terms of saying what they explicitly can't do. We've mostly said what they can do. And the anti-federalists who were at the Constitutional Convention and the ratification debates were really, really concerned about that listing. They were particularly concerned about the Necessary and Proper Clause, which is pretty broad, as we've covered before. So in the Bill of Rights, you have this 10th Amendment, which is, again, that catch-all to say, look, if we didn't list it in the Constitution as belonging to the federal government, and we didn't say that the states couldn't do it, then those powers should be reserved to the states, and that's why they are called the reserved powers. So let's talk a little bit more about what those powers are, and moving to slide 5, what I've outlined there is they are not exclusive powers. Exclusive powers refers to grants of exclusive authority to the federal government. So again, anything that is an enumerated power and listed as belonging to, like, Congress, that cannot belong to the state. Okay, so the state governments do not get exclusively federal powers. Concurrent powers, however, which are where the Constitution neither expressly nor implicitly precludes state legislation, that could be a state power. Again, going back to that listing on the previous slide, that is things like taxing. That is things like creating banks or creating your own court system. Our Constitution says that Congress can create courts, but it doesn't say that states can't create courts. So when it's not written out in the Constitution and we can't read into the wording to say that we don't think states should do that, then that could be a power of the state. The final description to clarify state powers is where we find ourselves not with something listed for the federal government and not something shared. And I've called this neither exclusive nor concurrent. And this becomes more contested. These might be state powers, but as I've written out there, these would be powers that if the state were to exercise them to the fullest extent, like all the way using as much power as they could, it would prevent the federal government from achieving the ends for which it was granted power. So this is really, again, contested. If the state goes too far, it's going to impede on the federal government and push back on what they are recognized as having power over. This might be something like the topic of immigration. And when that comes up, states are going to be given a little bit of leeway as long as it doesn't step on the toes of the federal government. But if it does cross that line, then we're going to have a pushback generally in the constitutional law realm to say state courts aren't granted that level of power. They can't really go to that extent. It's going to be really contested, though. This is a realm where we see tons of back and forth, even today, within the Supreme Court, within different levels of courts in the federal system. Where do we draw the line between states and federal, especially if we don't have a super clear identification in the Constitution of the powers of the federal government, or if the Supreme Court has had past cases which make it kind of unclear where do we draw the line? And I will throw immigration right out there as one where the Supreme Court has more recently said, we're going to consider that the states do have a role for this, but we don't necessarily take away the fact that the federal government really is kind of the top dog when it comes to that topic. Because immigration and naturalization generally have belonged to the federal government, and in fact, naturalization is written into the enumerated powers of Congress, but we can have pushback back and forth because of what are called the state's policing powers. I'll get to that here in just a minute, but I want to clarify this listing on slide 5 is saying the states cannot have the exclusive powers. They do have some concurrent powers. State might have the ability to jump in on that. It's going to be contested. And then where it's not listed for the federal government and it's not something that we would consider necessarily to be shared, there's, again, going to be a debate. Do the states have the power to do this, or is this something that belongs to the federal government? Now, with respect to that last point about what belongs to the federal government, the Supreme Court has laid out the concept of preemption. This is captured on slide 6 and defined. When federal and state policies collide, the Supremacy Clause, which is Article 6, Section 2, mandates that federal policy prevail. The process by which valid federal statutes, treaties, and administrative regulations supersede inconsistent state laws is known as preemption. So we're coming back to constitutional content here. The actual wording in Article 6 is that Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause is listed on slide 7. I'm going to read that for you before coming back to preemption. The Supremacy Clause says, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding." All right, very technical language, of course. But at its core, this says that the Constitution and federal laws are the things that stand above state law. The state laws are bound to follow the Constitution and federal law. And with preemption, going back to that concept, what that means is in the Supreme Court, if the federal government has made clear that they are trying to regulate a specific topic, again, going back to immigration, then that topic generally belongs to the federal government. They have power in that realm. The states don't get to step on that power or intercede. And that sets up, again, defining these domains. So what has been preempted by the federal government? Well, really, that term comes into play with cases around things like recognition of other countries or something to do with borders and boundaries, non-citizens. That really has been identified by the Supreme Court as being preempted by the federal government. So states have to tread lightly there if they want to make laws in that realm. Let's work with something of a more present day example. When the state of Texas sets up razor wire along its border, that is an instance of the state pushing back on what has been called a federal topic or a preempted topic of constitutional law. So Texas sets up razor wire. Sometimes you might hear it in the news called concertina wire. That just means it's round extensions of razor wire that can be expanded easily. That type of wire is what the state of Texas has as its policy for border protection. And what the federal government said was, well, this interferes with our ability to use, you know, our border patrol, our federal border patrol entities and agencies to enforce our immigration laws. So there's this back and forth between Texas and the federal government. And generally when that happens, what's going to be the case is the Supreme Court's going to sit down and evaluate a few questions listed here on slide 8. This comes out of Hines v. Davidowitz from 1940, where they're looking at, does the actions of a state stand as an obstacle to something that Congress has as an objective and or its purpose? Something that is a power of Congress that it has valid constitutional support to accomplish. So the questions are this: do the state laws or regulations conflict with federal requirements? That's going to be part one. If they do, the state laws are going to be struck down. Number two, does the pervasiveness of federal regulations signal an intention to, quote, occupy the field, end quote, and exclude state regulation? And here, really what the court is asking is, does the federal government intend to preempt this topic? Or by occupy the field, what they're meaning is, does the federal government intend to say that this is theirs and theirs only to regulate or restrict? If the answer to that second question is no, then we move on to the third question, which says, well, okay, if the state laws really aren't directly in conflict with the federal law and the federal government hasn't indicated that they want to, you know, take over this topic matter and keep the states out, would that state law still frustrate the purposes of that law? And frustrate is in quotations here. Really, what we're trying to get at is, are the states trying to undermine the federal government with laws that are going to be in conflict with what Congress has the power to regulate? So these three questions are a lot of what's going to guide that evaluation of preemption and whether, essentially, we're going to let the states make laws on a specific topic. Now, there's some interesting trends with respect to this concept of preemption. If you look at slide 9, I've given some different courts, as in like the courts that are under a certain Supreme Court justice. That's how we describe the Supreme Court. It has eras of the court, like the Warren Court or the Burger Court or the Rehnquist Court. So from 1940 to 1969, we have Chief Justice Stone, Chief Justice Vincent, and Chief Justice Warren. And the tendency with them was to say, hey, we're going to rule in favor of the federal government most of the time over state governments. We are in support of this concept of preemption, where the power to regulate something generally is allocated to the federal government. We're going to push more in that direction. In 1969 to 1986, is kind of a backswing on this pendulum of, okay, so we're going to try and find more of a middle point between the federal governments and the state governments on preemption. It's trying to say, okay, we're going to allow some exercise of state power here, particularly through into the 1980s, when we have more recognition and push for support of state powers. We're still going to protect the federal concerns, and so we're trying to do a balancing act here. But when you get to the post-1986 era, which is when we have Chief Justice Rehnquist and the current court under Chief Justice Roberts, the presumption against preemption of state laws is going to go down. What that means for the states is they're going to win a lot more in the Supreme Court, and the courts are going to strike down federal laws. So you may have seen this with something like United States v. Lopez, where Congress pushes through a gun control act under the idea of, hey, this is commerce and we're allowed to regulate commerce. And the Supreme Court's like, no, that's pushing too far beyond what we would call commerce. That's the kind of era that we're in under the Rehnquist and Roberts courts. Now, some other really hard to understand, and I honestly mean that because these are struggles to understand for even advanced law school students. These other concepts like dormant power theory, which is about the Commerce Clause, is what else can come into play with the battle between the federal and the states on powers. The dormant Commerce Clause, or the dormant power theory, you're going to hear it said either way, means that according to some people, by granting Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states, the Constitution implicitly prohibited state regulation of that commerce. All right, the translation here is this. The listing of that power to regulate commerce among the several states in the Constitution means that even though it wasn't expressly written out, that is meant to say states don't get to regulate that commerce. So even though we don't see it written in that kind of way, we're saying, guess what? The federal government has the power here ultimately over all of it, even when Congress doesn't take action. Oof, this is so complicated when it comes to constitutional law. Go to my translation slide. I'm going to read what's there. The larger argument and debate is this. If Congress regulates commerce, then that belongs to them to oversee. So whatever they choose to regulate is theirs. But if they also choose to not regulate something, that's still theirs. That's a choice being made, right? So if Congress says, we're not going to step in and say anything about, let's do a topic of today, healthcare rights for transgender youth. If Congress doesn't take any action on that, and again, we're talking about the Commerce Clause, so they would have to make it about the healthcare costs or use of some sort of healthcare trade laws. But let's say they do, and they make a law about that, or they choose not to make a law about that. That's still their power. Whether or not they exercise it, it still belongs to them. And my analogy on this screen or on this slide is it's like a cop deciding to write a ticket or not write a ticket. Whether or not the cop writes the ticket, they still have the power to do that, right? So this is what we're thinking about. If Congress writes something about a topic, they're expressing their power. But if they don't write something about it, they're still having the ability to do something about it. They're just choosing not to. The power still belongs to them. So this is, again, very complicated, but it comes into play when we think about what are state powers with respect to commerce, because this is, again, the contested topic or the thing that comes up a whole lot. What can states do about commerce? Like, we're talking about trade or different elements of markets. What are they allowed to do if Congress is supposed to be regulating the interstate commerce or commerce between states? Well, traditionally and historically, states have been able to regulate commerce when it happens within their own borders, generally speaking, and particularly in terms of their being able to impose taxes. Taxing, one of those concurrent powers that belongs both to the states and the federal, we have generally let states tax things in trade as they see fit, all right? The second larger category of commerce, and this is the one that's a little vague and cloudy and, again, harder to understand, are what are called policing powers. And we don't mean police in a straight law enforcement sense. But when it comes to commerce, states have had the police power to protect the health, safety, welfare, and morals of the population of that state. Now think about those terms. Health, safety, welfare, and morals. That's pretty dang broad, and it gives the states a lot of leeway with policing powers. So is a regulation from Congress about transgender youth health care something that belongs to Congress? Or could it fall under the policing powers of the states because we're talking about health and welfare, maybe even morals? What are we thinking about? We could be talking about safety. All of these things have vagueness and overlap, and that means they're going to be contested. So we're going to hear in the Supreme Court about those topics. One case on the docket for the Supreme Court right now is United States versus Scrimeti, which is specifically about transgender healthcare laws passed in specific states and whether those are constitutional or not. That, I believe, will be heard in 2025 unless something changes with respect to the United States making that case. Extending that discussion of policing powers, we have some folks who hear about dormant power theory and they push back because they have their own ideas about what this means. To them, they say, well, yeah, Congress might belong to Congress, but the states then have police power, right? That police power is what I've said before, the power to protect the health, safety, welfare, and morals of their citizens, and that belongs to the states alone. This is called mutual exclusiveness theory. Mutually exclusive means two things are completely separate and do not overlap. Congress has commerce and states have policing powers, and never the two shall cross over. They are mutually exclusive. It's a nice theory in the abstract, but again, these are very hard things to apply in a reality setting where we're honestly dealing with, well, what is the law about? Is it about commerce? How wide and broad are we going to define commerce? We've already done that conversation in our prior episode about what constitutes commerce. You know, they were debating, is it production or manufacturing? Where are the purpose lines? What activities? You know, where is the division? It's not so neat and clean, which means, again, this is something that's going to change over time. Our understanding is going to evolve. The dormant power theory argument is found a lot in the 1800s. So on slide 14, I've gone through some case history, beginning with 1824 and wrapping up in 1852 with the case of Cooley v. Board of Wardens. So in Ogden v. Gibbons, the court is like, yeah, dormant power theory makes sense to us. Just because Congress doesn't regulate something doesn't mean they don't have power over it. And then we jump to 5 years down the line in 1829, and then police powers allow somebody to dam up a stream which could be used for interstate commerce. So we're not really here saying Congress has power. We're having this contest between commerce and police powers. But by the time we get Cooley versus Board of Wardens in 1852, the court's like, nope, we're no longer down with this dormant power theory. We reject it. So at 1852, we are getting to the point now we need to draw some lines. Oh man, we're getting to this mess of the Commerce Clause, which remains a mess to this day. What can states regulate and what can't they? How are we going to make this a clear division of power? And in this era of federalism, I want you to think all the way back to kind of that evolution of federalism. We're still talking about state-centered federalism. We haven't gotten to the point where we're trying to focus on, you know, this clear and neat division of power between federal and state because it's still very much up in the air, still very much debated and contested. So what comes out in the Cooley decision, and the language is captured on slide 16, it says the Constitution does not expressly bar state regulation of commerce. So state regulations might be constitutional, depending on whether those regulations intrude on what Congress is allowed to do. Unless the nature of the power thus granted to Congress requires a similar authority should not exist in the states. All right, again, translation. The Constitution doesn't say states can't regulate commerce. It doesn't say states don't have any role with this. It's all going to depend on what Congress has done, okay? Unless that power is listed right? If the power is listed, that means that authority should not exist in the states. We're talking about things like, you know, go back to coining money. It's very, very clear. States don't get to do that. They don't get to play that role in commerce. But otherwise, we're going to have to take this on a case-by-case basis. So the Supreme Court's essentially delivering some form of job security. We're going to have to look at each law on terms of their subjects. And this throws us right back, folks, to that dual federalism side, which says, okay, where do we draw the line? Is it about selling or trade or creation or manufacture? Is it about the effects on interstate commerce, like direct effects or indirect effects? It is a tremendous mess. And it, again, continues to be a mess to this day. We haven't seen dormant power theory come up much recently, other than in 2023 with National Pork Producers Council versus Ross. What's going on in that case is 2018, California passes Proposition 12, which says we're not going to sell pork when the animals are confined in a way that we don't support. Like, California has certain standards, other states don't have those same standards, and we're just not going to sell pork if they confine the animals in a way that we don't like. And the argument back was, hey, this is messing with interstate commerce because you have pork producers outside of California who aren't adhering to these same standards because their states don't have those laws, right? The question that came before the court was, does that law, is it inconsistent with the dormant component of the Constitution's Commerce Clause? And the court here continues the trend under the Roberts Court. They say no. The states are allowed to regulate this. Quoting from what they've listed as the description on Oye, a state law that does have extraterritorial effects but does not purposefully discriminate does not necessarily violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. So guess what we're going back to? Questions about purpose. Boy, we are just so unclear on the Commerce Clause, historically speaking, and that means we're going to continue to have these debates. Now, a third theory about the realms of the federal versus the states when it comes to things even like commerce is called selective exclusiveness theory. Now, from this perspective, people would argue congressional power is exclusive, as in it belongs only to them, only in certain cases and with certain subjects. And exclusiveness when it comes to commerce and Congress is selective based on whether whatever topic they're dealing with is going to require uniform legislation. Do we need a standard that exists for the entire country, or can we get away with standards that are different in different states? So thinking about that last description for the National Pork Producers Council, they're saying no, pork can be restricted differently across the states. We don't think this is a realm where Congress needs to require uniform legislation, okay? So with all of this in mind, what we have now is the balancing test of state commerce power today. There's three questions to this captured on slide 19. Question number one, is there a valid purpose for the law? And valid purpose is going to be defined pretty broadly here, so they're going to be open to states having a valid purpose, meaning a lot of different things. Question number two, does the law unduly impede interstate commerce? Unduly impede means unnecessarily limit or restrict or restrain, something like that. Does it unnecessarily impose on interstate commerce? And question number three, do the benefits of the law outweigh the burdens on interstate commerce? We are swinging a little bit back with that question toward a balancing test. Something between the federal and state when it comes to this very nebulous and not understandable concept of commerce because, boy, we really, really struggle to define it. Now, historically speaking, there have been some lines drawn with what states can't do as far as commerce laws. Number one, which is going to be thrown out as soon as I think about, you know, the Pork Producers Council case, states should not be able to produce commerce laws that protect their own industries within the state. So in 1941, you can't limit competition for jobs. In 1984, you can't force timber to be processed in state. In 2005, you can't prohibit wine companies from shipping direct to customers from out of state. You can't protect your own state's industry with your commerce laws. You got to allow for competition because we're going to try and make it possible for the entire economy to grow. We got this national versus state dynamic. But again, you can think about what I've just talked about with the Pork Producers Council in 2023. Well, California can pass restrictions as far as the pork laws, and that's gonna be okay, right? Not only that, but having a legitimate state interest might not be enough to get past those series of questions. So 1951, Dean Milk Company versus City of Madison. In this case, the City of Madison says you can't bring in milk from a certain distance away from the city because we're worried about health issues. Is it pasteurized? Is it safe for the people to drink? And you can regulate milk for health reasons in that case, but it's not enough to limit interstate commerce. If we're going across state lines and it's only 50 or 60 miles, you are unduly impeding or burdening interstate commerce, right? City of Philadelphia versus New Jersey in 1978. You cannot discriminate between waste from within the state versus waste from without the state. You might have a legitimate state interest in that, but that's not going to be legitimate enough for you to pass your own commerce laws about it. And then in 1997, this is kind of an interesting version of a commerce law, but tax exemptions for in-state charities only violates the accepted standard. So if there was a tax exemption for an in-state charity, it needs to exist for out-of-state charities as well. There's just a lot of interesting cases on this, and there's a lot of history about state powers with respect to commerce and where we draw the line. And that transitions us into conversation about the cases we have listed for this week's reading. The first of these is Fletcher versus Peck from 1810, a notorious case coming out of the state of Georgia. The backstory here is corruption. In 1794, 1795 is generally the time period we're talking about. The Georgia legislature has a 35 million acre piece of land. It surrounds the Yazoo River, home to the Yazoo Nation, which is Native American peoples in that region of the world, or excuse me, that region of the United States. And the legislature decides to sell the land. They divvy it up into four pieces, and they decide to sell it to companies at the price of 1.5 cents per acre. The backstory and the corruption here is that all of this was done in exchange for bribes. The voters were so ticked that they literally removed pretty much the entire legislature that had been in office at the time that they made this land sale. And then the subsequent legislature comes in and they tried to void the sale, right? They try to repeal the Yazoo Act, and they try to void the sale. But other people at this point in time had bought some of the land. One of those people is John Peck. He's bought 13,000 acres from this whole situation. And then Robert Fletcher later purchases some of that land for $3,000. Fletcher finds out the Land Act has been voided, and he takes John Peck to court because he's like, you had promised me a good title and right to own this land, and now we don't have that title anymore. So what comes before the Supreme Court is, do the states have the power to invalidate contracts? Contracts like that tied into this case based on a corrupt land deal, right? This is still going to be commerce related. We're still talking about, you know, purchases and trade of some form, land for money. And there's a unanimous decision here where the legislature's repeal of that act is called unconstitutional because it violates the contract clause. So states may not like the terms of their own contracts, but they're going to have to adhere to that. It's binding. Even if there is illegal stuff going on in the background that sets up the commerce or whatever has happened, the states still have to stick with and enforce and ensure that the contracts are observed, because otherwise we lose the basis for a lot of potential commerce. Boy, a questionable and interesting decision at that point in time. But that being said, what this clearly establishes is that states do not get to impede on commerce if their imposition is going to void an existing contract. Case number two, one I've already mentioned in the past, Arizona versus United States from 2012, about SB 1070, which is related to immigration and what the state of Arizona pursued to try and enforce immigration laws with respect to their border, involved the use of law enforcement and checking individuals' identifications or papers, particularly with respect to maybe pulling someone over for a standard traffic stop. Do spend some time reading that case. Start out with the description in the textbook. And then I would say if you still have questions about that, go ahead and look it up. Read what is available to you on OYE and other sources. The section in the textbook on this is only pages 423 to 429. But if you get a strong sense of the case from that, don't feel like you have to go too much further unless you're doing the layman's terms on that case. Case number three, Comptroller of the Treasury of Maryland versus Wynn. No messing on this case. This is a complicated one. Even if you read it from the textbook or from OYE, this is the Dormant Commerce Clause. This is about taxes. Please don't beat your head in trying to work through this. Focus more here on what the court's reasoning is about the Dormant Commerce Clause, right? How does it tie into interstate commerce? What is the congressional needs here? And what is the justification that Justice Alito provides in the majority opinion, okay? When there is a description here in the textbook that you're struggling with, again, go back to OYE. It's a complicated case. I'm not going to lie. But it is an interesting one because as of 2015, when this decision is issued, this is one of the more recent, again, Dormant Commerce Clause cases. And that, for reasons that we've talked about before, is kind of interesting because we're still trying to figure out the boundaries here between state and federal and commerce, and how does that tie into taxes, and oof, yeah, that's a bit of a struggle for me to read through and understand. So if you have similar struggles, don't fret too much. Do the best you can with it. Our final case of state power gets into something that we haven't really touched on much in this episode, and that is the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That act is passed because even though we have the 15th Amendment in place relating to voting rights for individuals regardless of race, color, condition of servitude, there are still huge impediments in many states, particularly in the South, to Black Americans voting. They're using things like poll taxes where you have to pay to vote. They're using literacy tests. So if you can't read, you can't vote. Now, the workaround for the literacy tests is what we have as the grandfather clause. The grandfather clause refers to if your grandfather was able to vote, you are able to vote regardless of your literacy or not. So the Voting Rights Act of 1965 sets up that there is 100 years of discrimination related to voting. And because of this, any states that have this long history that can be demonstrated are going to have to go through the federal government before they can make any changes to their election laws and procedures. All right. I'm going to halt at that point in time because that's setting up more of the history of what this puts into place. And that stands for a very long time until we get Shelby County versus Holder, okay? So Section 5 of this Voting Rights Act is giving the federal government, Congress, the power with respect to elections in the states, which tends to be one of those powers reserved to the states. We get to 2013 with Shelby County versus Holder, and there is a change, particularly not just around Section 5, but Section 4. So as you read through this case, and focus again here on what I'm asking you to read, which is the syllabus. If you have further questions or concerns about understanding the case, I actually think the Oye site does a nice description here and helps to lay out some of the arguments. Of course, if you feel like you need more detail, jump into the opinion of the court. The entire set of opinions in this case, including the concurring opinion and the dissenting opinion here, are a total of 68 pages in PDF format. The syllabus itself is only going to run a total of 4 pages. It's not the longest read, but it's definitely establishing a different dynamic with respect to state power related to the Voting Rights Act. We've been talking this entire time about commerce and maybe even policing powers, but the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is well after that period of time of the Constitution's development. So when the Constitution's written, we talk about elections being belonging to the states. That's a power of the states, reserved to the states. And then we revise that following this history of discrimination, which again ties into actually federal law because it's violation of the 15th Amendment. Where do we draw the line when there's evolution in the issue and the situation? Okay. That's going to conclude my material description for this week's episode. Please remember to read the 2 papers assigned to you. These are 2 papers from other course members. We're offering feedback to them on what they have developed for their initial drafts. Where you can find those peer reviews, you should be able to, in the desktop version of Canvas, go to your dashboard. And under the dashboard view, you'll see a recent activity, you see a card view, you see a list view. I've captured a screenshot or a snippet of this on slide 25. Under the recent activity, it should show you the peer reviews, but you should also be able to see these if you go to the peer reviews rubric and marked up copy submission. What I need you to do in this assignment is read the papers, fill out the rubric, and then leave electronic annotations on their PDF copy of their document. Electronic annotations are where you suggest, you know, different spelling or grammar, or maybe you have a question about what someone has said. You can actually put in those notes electronically on the draft. If you have questions or concerns about how to do this, please check out the video links that I have posted with the announcement about the peer reviews. And then if you have any further difficulties, don't hesitate to reach out and let me know, and I will help you as quickly as I can. Next time, we will discuss the Constitution and Native American tribes, and boy, there is a lot of history there, so we'll probably have a lengthier episode next time, but we won't get to it all because there's just so much case history in that realm. I wish you a great rest of your week, and I will connect with you again soon.